Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting. I'll be the moderator for today's program, Challenges to Covering International News. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Jali Dayi, who will introduce our distinguished speaker. Jali is a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Directors, a managing partner of Aurora Equity. She is the first woman who is on the U.S. Space Foundation and a noted scientist and educator in her own right. Please welcome Jali.
Thank you, Robert. I'm truly delighted to introduce an exceptional woman and fellow Iranian-American, Parisa Khosravi. She's an award-winning journalist with 3 decades of global news gathering experience. As Senior Vice President of International and Domestic News Gathering and Global Relations for CNN Worldwide, Parisa directed CNN's historic coverage of award-winning news stories, including coverage of Tiananmen Square, Iraq wars, fall of the Iron Curtain, the 9/11 disaster, Hurricane Katrina, Japan tsunami, and Haiti earthquake, and many others, including Arab Spring and the Syrian civil war. In its farewell to Parisa, when she decided to pursue new opportunities, CNN praised her by saying, and I'm quoting, "No one has played a greater role in emergence and then dominance of CNN international news gathering than Parisa." This is pretty strong statement. Some of these historic events, as CNN's first ever ambassador and senior vice president for global relations, Parisa built and maintained ongoing working relationships with world leaders, dignitaries, and high-ranking officials, while ensuring top editorial access and forging positive strategic relationships for the network all over the world. Parisa is a recognized authority on safety and security matters for her meticulous and decisive management of her staff as they cover the world's most dangerous hotspots, conflicts, and natural disasters. With over 2 decades at the leading global news network, Parisa's responsibilities spanned across editorial, operational, and administrative departments, which included 45 CNN bureaus worldwide and more than 100 correspondents, as well as large behind-the-scenes support staff around the world. It is my pleasure to invite Parisa to the podium.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Jalijan. We have certainly seen a great deal of change in recent years in the way we cover news and the way we consume news. I thought today I would share with you my perspective on a couple of areas that have specially seen a change and also changed the way we gather news. One is technology, and the other one is safety. I have had the awesome and humbling experience of being part of a news network that changed the world as we knew it. CNN, of course, as you know, was the original 24/7 news network, the vision and passion of Ted Turner, who wanted to bring the world the news every day, all day long, and everybody thought he was crazy. And they said, who would want to watch news all day long? And they called CNN chicken noodle news at one point. But Ted stuck to his guns and started CNN on June 1st, 1980. And I consider CNN really the ultimate startup and the original social media. Of course, CNN became a household name during the first Iraq war in 1990-91. And the rest is really history. I joined CNN, I was recruited by CNN in 1987, so just a few years earlier. And I thought I would just give you a little background on how and why I got into the business. I actually remember the exact day and the hour. I'm originally, I was born in Iran, I was raised in Iran, and left just before the 1979 revolution. I watched the news intensely and to follow what was happening back in Iran. And of course, a few months after the revolution, the hostages were taken, the American hostages were taken. So I kept up with the news every night by watching the program America Held Hostage, day number, whatever it was, hosted by Ted Koppel, which then became Nightline. So the day that the hostages were released, I was watching all day long, and the live arrival of their the coverage of their arrival in Germany at Rhein-Main Air Base. I remember them watching intently as they were kind of stepping down the stairs from the plane and being met by the officials. I was mesmerized. I was just so happy, and it was such an exciting time. And I the only other people I could see besides the former hostages and the officials were the journalists running around on the tarmac behind the scenes trying to get the story and talk to the hostages. And it was such an exciting moment for me. I wanted to be right there. I wanted to be in the middle of it all, right on that tarmac with them. So the next day, I went to my English teacher. I was a sophomore in high school then, Mr. Wagner. And I said, "Mr. Wagner, I want to be a journalist. What do you suggest I do?" And he said, "Oh, Pariso, you know, journalism is just such a tough field, and it's so competitive, and English is your second language, and you have an accent." So he did not encourage me to pursue my newfound passion. So I actually ignored Mr. Wagner from then on this topic. And I went on to college. I majored in broadcast journalism. I did 7 internships. Every semester I did one. And then CNN came to my school, and I got recruited. Started within a week of graduation. And that was in 1987. And of course, as I said, CNN itself became a household name with the Iraq War. The night that the war broke out, CNN was the only news organization live from Baghdad. And everybody else actually took the signal. And from then on, the expectations of the audience truly grew. So every time something would happen around the world, they expected to turn CNN on and watch it live, wherever it was and whatever was happening. So, and of course, there was no on and off switch to make that happen. It was a lot of folks behind the scenes running around trying to move mountains and make it all happen. I thought I would share with you one of the experiences that we had. I didn't have to move a mountain, but I diverted a commercial airliner. This was in 92. If you remember, Somalia was going through a civil war. There was a horrible famine, and the UN decided to have a resolution pass a humanitarian relief aid that the U.S. was going to lead. For some reason, the vote on this resolution got moved up by a few days, and we lost that time to get our people into the region and into Somalia in time to cover the landing of the Marines who were going to start this humanitarian aid. So we were all scrambling, all news organizations really were, to get our people essentially to the region, and that was the neighboring Kenya. And then from there, we were going to transport everybody into Somalia. One of the equipment that we had to take in, this was the technology we had to use at the time, it's called a flyaway. And it's a satellite uplink. It's a portable satellite uplink. It's actually the same technology we used to come out of Iraq live for the Gulf War. This thing weighs about 2,000 pounds, and it breaks down to about 20 cases when we had to move it around. And at the time, it was sitting in our bureau in Cyprus. We had a bureau in Cyprus at that time. So finding a flight from Cyprus to Kenya was turning out to be a challenge. As you can imagine, there weren't that many flight options. So we were looking at charter options, and the charters were too small. You know, to break down this equipment and put it in these big cases, nothing would fit a small charter plane. So we started looking, you know, working backwards. What's the next flight getting into Nairobi, where everybody was gathering? And then where is that coming from? And we found that it's a flight from that was coming from London at the time. So I asked my colleague, I said, why don't we call, because we couldn't get ourselves to London in time to catch that flight. I said, why don't we call the airline and ask them if they would at all consider stopping in Cyprus to pick us up. For the sake of the airline, I won't mention the airline's name. And so she said, okay, and she called them up, and she called me back, and she said, Paris, you won't believe this, but they are asking us how much are we willing to pay? And I said, well, now this is a negotiation. And just a little background on this equipment. In the past, when we've had to move it, we'd paid upwards of $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 in excess baggage to move this flyaway. And then we had four people on the ground that we wanted to get on that flight as well, and in business class seats, so it easily could have been $100,000 expense. So wanting to leave myself some room for negotiation, I said, let's offer 30. And she called them up, and she called me back, and she said, they accepted, just like that. And she said, but the key is that they want you to, they want us to wire the money immediately, because they want to know that we're serious, and so for them to get permission to change flight paths and get landing rights. So at this time now, I called my boss, and it was around 3 in the morning, and I'd worked on this thing 28 hours straight, and I said, don't ask me any questions. I've tried everything. If there's any chance of us getting there in time, you know, this is it. So can you approve $30,000 being wired to this airline? And he's a wise man. He said, just go for it. You know, he didn't even know what to ask me. So I had our bureau chief go ahead and wire the money from the bureau to the airline. And then I just kind of got nervous, thinking, oh my God, what have I done? Put all our eggs in one basket. You know, we can't even now try to catch some other flights and get there somewhat on time. What if this airline just take the 30,000? I've lost the company's money. And then they say, what money and what landing in Cyprus? So anyway, so around the time that the plane was supposed to, a few hours later, it was kind of en route. My colleague talked her way up to the control tower at the airport. This was pre-9/11, so a very, very different world. So she called me up, and she said, Paris, did they see the plane on radar? So that's a good sign. And then a little bit later, she said that she called and she said, the plane is descending, and it's now landed. So you can imagine I was in the middle of the newsroom jumping up and down, very excited that we just pulled off something very incredible. And but the punchline to this story really is that because the flight was coming from London, and it was the first one getting into the region, and London is a hub for you know, most news organizations. Their biggest bureaus, international bureaus, are usually based in London. So all the US networks, ourselves, our biggest bureau outside the US is in London. And of course, the British networks themselves and some other organizations. That plane was full of other journalists. Oh. So you can imagine in the middle of the flight when the pilot had come on and said, we're making an unscheduled landing in Cyprus to pick up CNN. Folks were not happy. Not only were they getting delayed, but the competition was getting on board. So my colleague later on told me, Brent Sadler was our correspondent bureau chief at the time, who got on board, and he said that one of the reporters from the other U.S. Nets had jumped up and wanted to choke him and say, who the heck do you think you people are? So anyway, others had pulled him back. But that story, you know, we got on, and really it goes on because we had chartered a Russian Antonov in Nairobi to go to Mogadishu with all the gear and the folks, and we actually picked up some of our competitors on board as well. It's a whole different story. I could go on for the day on this one, because it landed in the wrong airstrip in Mogadishu. It was actually a drug strip that they delivered drugs on, so it tried to take off again, and the strip wasn't long enough. It hit its landing gear, then we were going to make a belly landing back in Nairobi, and they were going to dump all the equipment. I mean, it just became like, but all that to say, we got there, we finally got to Mogadishu in time and covered the story, of course, that Somalia story, as you remember, changed from a humanitarian effort to a hostile situation months later with the story Black Hawk Down that then became a movie, and it was one of the most difficult, dangerous stories we covered. Got a lot of awards, actually an Emmy for it too, but it's the type of things we have to do sometimes too, so you get a sense of the technology that had to be used. And nowadays, your cell phone is what you can use to do a live shot. I mean, look at the change. It is mind-boggling that, you know, when you're doing FaceTime, when you're doing Skyping, in a pinch, that can be a live shot for journalists around the world, and what a difference that is, and the flexibility and the mobility that it gives us from what we had to do. The other aspect that I mentioned that has changed so much is, of course, safety and security of our people. It used to be that as journalists, we used to announce ourselves. We were like the Red Cross, we were the neutral zone. We would show up in conflict areas and we would not be the intentional targets. It is so sad to see the state of things now. Journalists have become the biggest prize in some cases, in some conflicts. Kidnappings, ransoms, killings. We've seen the horrible, torturous videos of ISIS beheadings of innocent journalists and civilians. Just last week, the UN announced in a report that pretty much one journalist is killed every 5 days around the world, which is just horrible. Personally, I think that shift happened, especially, I mean, here and there would be incidents, but I think the intentional targeting of journalists, in my opinion, I think that shift happened during the Bosnian War. You know, in Sarajevo, there was this sniper alley that they used to call it. And journalists were clearly marked as journalists. You know, their flak jackets would say press, their helmets would say TV, their cars would be marked as press TV. So there was no mistake that who they were aiming at were journalists. And journalists were being shot at. One of my dear friends and colleagues, camerawoman extraordinaire Margaret Moss, was shot in the face by a sniper in Sarajevo. A bullet went in through her cheek and came out of her jaw. I remember taking that call and my colleague saying that Margaret had just been shot and by a sniper, and that they were rushing her to the field hospital, the UN field hospital, trying to save her. Thankfully, they did, and they stabilized her, and she was immediately flown out of Sarajevo to Germany, where she was further stabilized, and we medevaced her to the US, to Mayo. And I remember arranging for her mom, Margaret was from New Zealand, for her mom, Noni, to fly from New Zealand to the States, her boyfriend from Paris, one of her good friends from Dallas. And I went up myself as well to be there when she arrived. And I wanted to go in the room, and I remember my boss telling me, don't go in there if you can't handle it, because she's looking for your reaction. She didn't know how badly injured she was. She had not been given a mirror. So I went in the room, and I tell you, her head was like the size of two basketballs. I will never forget that. It's amazing what the body does facing a trauma like that. And all I could see were her two blue piercing eyes looking at me and trying to kind of gauge my reaction. And I took a notepad to her and a pencil, and she wrote down, first thing she wrote down was, I want to go back to Sarajevo to look for my teeth. This was Margaret. I mean, she was an incredible, incredible one. She was at the time in her early 40s, beautiful woman, and she, you know, she had to go through dozens and dozens of surgeries to reconfigure her face. And sadly, she got hepatitis C. They think because of the massive transfusion she got on the ground when they were trying to save her. And then years later, she actually had stage 4 cancer. And Margaret continued to fight through the whole thing. And I remember one of the last times she came to my office, I asked her, and this is probably the only conversation I would have had with somebody, and it was Margaret, I said, how would you like us to handle things at the end? And she said that she didn't want to see anybody in the final days, and that she wanted to be cremated and her ashes taken to Istanbul, where she was last based. And I said, of course we would handle that. And she checked herself into a hospice, and she's the only one that I know of who took a vacation from her hospice stay. And during the Christmas holidays, went and stayed with her friends, and then went back to the hospice, and she passed that March. And just before she passed, she asked to see me, it was such an honor, because she had specifically told me she didn't want to see anybody at the end. And the conversation I had with her was, it's a lifetime lesson. If you want to be inspired, you should watch this documentary we did on Margaret Moss. If you go to CNN.com and search her MLTH, you can't help but be inspired by who she was. Sadly, it's not just the physical well-being of our people that we have to be mindful of and take care of. CNN actually has a policy that we do not send people into war zones unless they volunteer to go in. It's such a marathon career. It is such a difficult, it's so difficult. You can't go into these war zones and see so much tragedy and not be impacted by it. So I often would ask our colleagues to take care of themselves and their emotional and mental well-being. We have on board one of the best in the business, Dr. Anthony Feinstein, whose specialty is journalists in war zones and PTSD. And I would ask our colleagues to confidentially speak to him and do head laundry, essentially, not let things pile up, because sometimes a sound, a scent, a smell stays with you, and it can have an impact in the mood and the personality of our folks. The combination of the smaller, more flexible equipment that I was talking about with the targeting of journalists can be a very dangerous situation, especially for up-and-coming journalists, for freelancers who want to make a name for themselves and sometimes put themselves in dangerous situations or are faced with very, very difficult circumstances. As far as technology goes, it's a very exciting time. There's these cameras, 360-degree cameras now, that we used them for the first time in Haiti during the 2010 earthquake, that you kind of see everything around you. It's not just the pictures ahead, but every angle you can now see and feel like you're right there. Just a couple of weeks ago, actually, I was in New York. I attended this conference, partly organized by a dear friend, Mitch Gelman from Gannett, on virtual reality storytelling. So it's the combination of this 360 camera, with these goggles and headsets that is surround sound that completely blows your mind. You feel like you are right there, you know, witnessing things. I mean, Discovery is doing programming with it. New York Times just this past weekend sent out 1 million Google cardboard goggles that essentially you put your phone in and you download the app and you can look around and whatever video story that they have on there, you can see every angle of it. And depending, again, the goggles getting much more advanced and the degree that you, the latest versions that you get, it is like being in the middle of things. So it kind of reminds me of my childhood dream of wanting to be right on that tarmac and being right in the middle of things. I think it's not just for journalists anymore, but civilians can feel like they can be in the middle of things by using this latest technology that's coming our way. It's already here in some cases. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to take your questions. Thank you.
Our thanks to Parisa Khosravi, former Vice President for Global Relations and News Gathering at CNN, for her comments about challenges to covering international news. Now it's time for the question and answer period. I'm Robert Rosenthal, your moderator for today's question and answer period. We have a lot of questions, so let's get started. You talked a little bit about the changes, obviously, with technology and information gathering from, say, when CNN was started in 1980. To today. So with all the technology and all the access to the internet, do you think Americans are more or less informed about international news today?
Well, we certainly have more access. I think that the options are so great, the resources are so vast. We have even access now not just to our own news organizations, but news organizations from around the world. You can pick up any paper that maybe would have taken a week or two to get to you if you subscribe to it from a different country. Now you can just look it up on the web and get the latest information from any country, anywhere. So whether folks are doing that, I'm not sure, but we certainly have more access.
Yeah, I spent a lot of my career in international news as well, and I think there is a lot more information available, but and I'd love to hear your reaction to this as somebody who's spent so much of your career in international news, and CNN certainly made its reputation the way you described it. But do you think we know more, or do Americans really care? I think it's one of the concerns I have, that we're not exposed to the rest of the world, and in a way that really is more than superficial at times.
I think Americans care. I don't subscribe to the idea that they don't. CNN really, as I said, became a household name because of international news. Every time there was a major news event, the interest would be there and people would be watching. So I think the way it's presented is key. Depending on the story itself, the background, and how it relates to our lives here in the States, people's interests go up and down.
One of the things that has happened also is that because of the collapse of the business model for a lot of media companies, especially newspapers, there are much fewer foreign correspondents than there used to be based overseas. People tend to parachute in. I'm not sure of the numbers with CNN. But you mentioned in your talk, and it's something like most people, and I don't think really think about, is the risk journalists take. I think you said every 5 days a journalist is killed around the world. We're fortunate here. It doesn't happen that often. How would you define some of these journalists? Because one of the things that has happened is sometimes people who are less experienced than you certainly were, or the CNN staffers were, are out there. Do you see that happening, that some people are put at risk who might really not have the experience, and obviously the risks that local journalists take?
That's so true. We certainly have a very strict policy for our safety standards, the way we send people out and the measures we take before we send them out and the training we put them through. It's very established, and we don't mess around with that. And thankfully, knock on wood, we haven't had any serious situations for a long while. Not every organization has all those measures in place, and especially, as I mentioned, freelance journalists who want to go and get a story and then sell that story, in some cases, end up putting themselves at great risk as well. So it's a very varied field, and it is getting more dangerous because, sadly, when journalists are caught or kidnapped, it is the biggest bang for the buck sometimes for whatever group it is that has them to get the coverage and the publicity. So it's very, very challenging.
I have to be honest. We talked a little bit before today, so I have a few questions. You tell me a really fascinating thing about Ted Turner and a decision he made early on with CNN. Could you talk a little bit about that? And it really was about language.
Yeah, I cringe when you said the word foreign correspondence. foreign was the F word at CNN. Ted, years ago, soon after CNN started, he didn't want us to use the word foreign. And his thought was that we're an international news organization. Who's the foreigner? You know, he didn't want that them and us attitude in the newsroom, in how we did things. And I so honor him and respect him for that kind of philosophy. And that was the type of mindset that the staff at CNN had. We changed the name of the desk from foreign desk to international desk. Most news organizations have a foreign desk. If we were overheard saying the word foreign, we would get charged $50. They didn't pay us enough to charge us $50. In our reports on air, our anchors, our reporters could not use the word foreign. I mean, we would actually kill a package and redo it and use a different word. And I remember I was in Moscow during the Soviet days. For a while I was producing there, and you know, it was tough to be in a third country talking about foreigners in that country. How do you explain that? How do you, you know, so you remember we had done a piece and somehow the word foreign had slipped in, and Atlanta called and said you have to redo the piece. So that's how, you know, there's a story. I'm not sure if it's true or not, but it went around for a while that one day Ted had called the control room. We were carrying a press conference by a bunch of foreign ministers. And he had called and said, do we have to call them foreign ministers? So Ted, that's their title. We can't change their title.
So currently, obviously, I can't avoid this question, but can we talk a little bit about your perceptions of Iran and the media? President Rouhani yesterday, or over the weekend, made comments about the media, really, which I found fascinating. He sort of challenged the media, really going at saying they're really in its own coded way saying that the government control of media is hurting the country. An American journalist, American Iranian Jason Rezaian, who many of us know, is held. How would you know what as a journalist, and you, if you had to cover Iran today, would you feel safe as a journalist and a woman going in there, especially if you weren't, say, working for a big company like CNN? And how, what are the challenges of working there?
I went back to Iran as a journalist years ago. It was the first time I went back after 15 years, about. And I went back many times throughout the years. I produced our coverage from there with Christian Amanpour as our correspondent. And we did a lot of good stories. We did a lot of exclusives, interviewed a lot of folks and presidents at different times. It's difficult working in Iran for especially the local journalists, and they are very, you know, determined and trying to get the story, and depending on, you know, the type of newspapers they work for or the radio or TV stations that they work for, it could be different agendas. It is mostly state-run, so it can be difficult, and yet sometimes they end up paying the highest price as well and end up in jail. You know, as a journalist myself, I absolutely believe in freedom of press, and do not think journalists should end up in jail for doing their job.
When one of the, what was one of your more memorable days as a journalist?
I've had many, you know, good and bad for different reasons. speaking of Iran, Christiane and I got the first exclusive interview with President Khatami of Iran in 98 when he became president. I think you remember President Khatami, when he was first elected, he was actually in the US press, was labeled as the smiling mullah. Anyway, President Khatami was going on his first international trip in 99. He went to Italy as his first trip. We wanted to go cover it. I was in the States, Christiane, I think, was in London. We were going to go to Rome and cover his trip. I have a dear friend in Rome, Father Giulio, and I called him up. I said, Father Giulio, I'm going to be in town. By chance, are you around? I would love to see you. And he said that he wouldn't be in the country when I was visiting. He said, but Parisa, would you like to meet the Papa? I said, meet the Pope? Of course I'd love to meet the Pope. And he said, well, let me see if I can arrange it. And I said, so he called me back a few days later and he said, it's arranged. Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock, you can go to the Vatican and you're gonna, you know, see the Pope in a little private audience. So, wow. And then meantime, I had asked for a meeting with President Khatami for myself and Christiane. So his people called and said, Ms. Khosravi, the meeting is set Wednesday at 10 o'clock. So I couldn't cancel either one of them. Didn't want to. I remember going and I thought the Pope at 9, I had the President at 10, and I thought, okay, well, the Pope, you know, maybe 9:15, say 9:30, you know, at the most 9:45, he's a busy man, maybe he'll just wave at us or something, and then, you know, get in a car and go from the Vatican to the hotel that was nearby for the 10 o'clock. So anyway, the morning of the meeting, I go through the gate that they told me, met with this by the Swiss guards, they take me to this room, and we're waiting, and a few other folks come in the room, about 20 total, and mostly were sisters and priests. And so I was kind of sticking out like a sore thumb, and then it just became 9:05, 9:10, 9:15, 9:20, and I'm like, my stomach is turning into a knot, and like 9:25, and I keep looking at my watch. And sister next to me turns around, she says, are you late for something? And I said, no, ma'am. It's 9:30. So now I'm really getting anxious because there's absolutely no sign of any movement. And so 9:40, finally, I see this other guy on the other side of the room. He looked like a civilian like myself. So I saw that he had a cell phone. And this was 99. We really didn't have the cell phone and the accessibility. And there was a rotary phone on this corner, and I tried it. I couldn't get out, and so I went to him. I said, can I borrow your phone for a second? And so he gave me his phone. I called President Khatami's people. I said, I'm so sorry. I'm stuck. I didn't even tell him where I was. And I said, I'm stuck, but Ms. Amanpour is right there. Please go ahead and have the meeting with her. And they said, oh, it's okay, Ms. Khosravi. Just get here as fast as you can. We'll move things until you get here. So finally, like I said, okay, so 9:50, they come in at the Vatican, they usher us out of the room, and they take us down this amazing hallway down to the private quarters of the Pope, and they usher us into his private chapel. And right there at the end of it, there's the Pope with his back to us, kneeling at the altar. And so I sat down, he was gonna do a private service. And I sat down, and I looked at my watch, and it was exactly 10 o'clock, so I was officially late for the president. And I thought to myself, for God's sakes, trust this. You're in the Vatican, and there's the Pope. Just calm down. So I promised myself I wouldn't look at my watch, and I just sat there, and I really took in the experience. It was quite special. And then they let us out at 10:30. And they said that the Pope will come and greet us. So I thought I was being clever and standing in front of the line, but it was actually the end of the line. Anyway, he came and shook our hands. And I'm Zoroastrian, which is a minority religion in Iran. It's an ancient religion. And Pope John Paul was such a special, learned guy, and he so knew about religions. I so wanted to tell him, like, I'm a Zoroastrian. I don't know if you've met one of us before. But I was in such a rush that I just shook his hand, and he gave me a blessed rosary, and then that was it. And I then ran down the hallway, and these Swiss guards are like, stop, you have to all go together. I'm like, I'm going. Anyway, I went in, and of course, what I wore for the Pope worked for the president as well, by the way. Scarf and everything else.
So did you explain to the president why you were late, and what did he have to say?
I did not. Thankfully, I don't know if he even knew, because his people just moved things around, but he was very, very gracious, and he met us both.
Okay. We'd like to remind our listening audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Challenges to Covering International News. Our speaker is Parisa Khosravi, former Senior Vice President for Global Relations and News Gathering at CNN. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting. So if you were in your job today at CNN and you were trying to figure out the challenge of covering the fighting in Syria and Iraq, which I feel like we almost know nothing really that's happening on the ground, how would you do it, or would you even consider it based on the risks you talked about earlier today?
Well, CNN still goes in there. There was a report from Erbil just a couple of weeks ago. It is very, very difficult. It's very challenging. Every time we send people in, it's a major decision. We have a lot of folks who we rely on in country, outside, in the region, fixers that we talk to, who are our contacts, trying to kind of organize a trip going in. Before we go in, we plan the whole trip as far as where they're going, and while they're there, we're monitoring them, and you know, I don't talk about detail of the security plans, but it's something that you the reporters, we have an incredible group of folks who continuously push to go into these countries and get the stories. And you know, I know four or five probably right now that who have pitches every day who would want to go into different parts of the region and try to do the story from different angles. And they never back down, and it's really a kind of coming up with the best, safest plan to send them in there, and CNN still does it regularly.
So if you were, again, hypothetically, if you were in that job, what part of the world do you think you'd like to see more coverage from, or how would you try and convince, say, whoever you had to convince in CNN that you have to get in there and do more reporting for a story?
Well, I did do it for so long. It was a lot of times them convincing me, and because, I mean, it was our teams, our correspondents, and it was challenging because, you know, one of my nicknames at CNN was Mother Parisa. Not just because I'm just warm and fuzzy, it was because I really cared deeply for the safety of our people. And a lot of times I would pull them back from stories just kind of have a gut reaction and say, don't go, or it's time to leave, or I can't send you in right now. And sometimes they would get very frustrated, but I don't think there's anything more important than their safety and well-being. So, of course, you know, as you just said, the story of, you know, Syria, Iraq, Libya, these have become very, very dangerous and difficult places to cover. And we certainly have covered them throughout the years and will do so, but the stories are not going to be every day. It's not like you can go there and do a live shot in the middle of everything, because sadly, as I said, journalists themselves have become such targets that it continues to be very difficult. But we do them, and we do them very carefully.
Has Russia, from your point of view, gotten more complicated and difficult to cover well? Because of the changes in the political situation there, and the control, really, of the Russian, I'll call it their state media.
You know, Russia, as certainly the journalists in Russia have had their challenges in some cases. There have been some who have been targeted in the past, and no information or reason given or found out at the end of why they were hurt or killed in some cases. So it's a difficult place to cover. Of course, with the Ukraine story, that had its own challenges as the fighting went on. And even, you know, when the plane went down, getting to the region, because there was fighting, and there were sometimes they would prevent journalists from even getting close to the plane. It was the Malaysian airline, you remember, a year or two ago that went down. So it is, Russia continues to be one of the tougher places. We have a bureau there. But it's not the same as these other places that I'm talking about, but it can have its own bureaucracies.
Were you ever personally frightened when you were on the ground, or were you more frightened for people you had on the ground?
Yes, certainly one prefers to put oneself in risk than, you know, give green light for others to go in. I was in Iraq once, and I think this was during Saddam's times. Saddam didn't like Iranians much. There was an eight-year war between Iran and Iraq, and Saddam just... He hung a British-Iranian journalist, if you remember, years back, and the UN appealed, Thatcher appealed, and he said his background is Iranian, I don't care, and he hung him. So when I was there, that was kind of very uncomfortable. This was the time when there was air embargo, so we had to go via land. We went through Jordan, middle of the night, border crossing, they do AIDS tests on you. With sometimes dirty needles, so we would take our own needles. It's like, thank you, please use ours. Then, trying to do an AIDS test on us. And going in, being there for a few days, and meeting with top officials from the time, Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz and others, it was odd for them that I had, my background was Iranian. They couldn't figure that out, and they couldn't kind of understand how I was in the position that I was. And it was unpredictable, because at any time they could just kind of say, well, she's somebody and we are keeping her. And there was nothing anybody could do, because again, a few years earlier, an Iranian British guy had been hung. So that was uncomfortable, because it felt like it was completely out of my control.
Did you ever think, what am I doing here? Why am I doing this job?
I went because I wanted to visit our bureau, and I felt like they were there. I needed to go see them.
So that, was that before, after, when was
this
that?
This was between the two wars.
Like in the mid-90s?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And putting someone at risk, and you've done it, so in other words, I think what you've experienced when you've been an international correspondent yourself, and you know the risk you've gone through, and putting someone in that situation gives you some insights and knowledge. And you said that at CNN people volunteer. You don't ask or insist someone go. But what was the situation where someone you had put into a situation where you really were either frightened or had moments or hours where you didn't know what was happening? How did you handle that, and how do you manage that?
There were so many. One of the ones that comes to mind, I remember Nick Robertson, one of my colleagues, was doing an interview with a Taliban spokesman, and I was very concerned for his safety. I just wasn't sure if it was going to turn into an ambush or a kidnapping or anything like that, and kind of talked to him a number of times about where he was going to meet this guy and how it was going to be done and what kind of measures we had in place and so forth. And I remember finally... close to the time that he was supposed to do the interview, I called him up and he said, "Pris, I'm going to the interview." I said, "I know, just leave your phone on and let me just put me in your pocket." So while he was doing the interview, the phone was on. So I couldn't really hear much that was happening, but I could at least know that he's okay, that if there was a noise, that something changed dramatically, I would know instantaneously that something had gone wrong. And then when he finished the interview and got in the car, and he's like, "Can I hang up now?" It's like as if his mom is like. So I've done things like that.
Well, it would have been an honor to work for someone like you who cared so much about her staff, so that's a good thing. One of the most dramatic news stories, breaking news stories under your watch, and one that CNN did an incredible job covering, was the Mumbai attacks. Can you tell us if you can recall, the moment you learned about it, what you did, and take us through the next 12 or 24 hours?
Wow, yeah, Mumbai was oof, it was around Thanksgiving, if you recall, 2008. Yeah, I remember I was in my office and I was just kind of doing whatever, and then there were a few bulletins crossing on the computer that says, there was shootings in Mumbai. And, you're looking at it and thinking, I wonder what this is. And I remember I called one of our colleagues on the ground. We had a bureau in Mumbai. And I said, do you know about this? What is happening? And they're like, we're checking into it to see if it's a criminal act or, you know, terror attack. And as they were checking into it, you know, more bulletins crossed that there were more shootings, and it seemed like there was a five-star hotel and a rail station at the time, and there were a couple of other locations. So it was starting to build up, so you could tell this was an organized event, attack happening. So as we started covering it, we got another call from our corporate office from Turner in Hong Kong saying that we had a number of our staff members, not journalists, part of the corporate office, sales department, who were meeting in Mumbai for an event, for a conference, and they were staying at the Taj Hotel where the attack was happening. So all of a sudden, as we were covering this as a news story, we realized that we have folks in danger inside the hotel. So we're becoming part of a story, the story ourselves. Of course, we weren't reporting on that part of it because, you know, you had so many people inside the hotel who were in danger. So we quickly figured out who's on the ground and are they inside the hotel? Could they be out for dinner or something? And there were about six people who were in their rooms in the hotel. So quickly kind of got in touch with all of them and gave them some early guidance as to, like, lock your door, turn off the lights, turn off the TV, turn your phone into silence, you know, hide behind a bed or a desk so if they knock the door down, they don't see you immediately. So we were going through this. Meantime, we're talking to our security experts and what to do and then trying to get in touch with officials, also say that we had teams there and so forth, and meantime covering the story as a news story on our air. And then this was a few hours later, and it was middle of the night in Mumbai. You may recall that we could see from our live shot that there was smoke rising from one of the wings of the hotel. So the hotel was on fire. And and this was not a much more urgent matter. So I was messaging with them, group message, and said, you know, go behind the door, look for the exit, and run towards the exit, get out of the hotel, and we had folks circling, trying to pick them up. So one by one, they got out, thankfully, and then there was one person I didn't hear from, and she wasn't responding. I called her up. I said, you know, where are you? And she said, I'm in my room. And I said, why haven't you left? And she said, you told me not to leave. I said, that was hours ago. I just told you to leave. And she said, but you told me not to leave. And I could tell she was frozen in her fear. And, you know, I couldn't blame her. I mean, you know, she's not a journalist, you know, war zone expert. So I had to yell at her. I mean, like, I had to shake her out of it. And I said, just, you know, I pretty much just, like, okay, let's walk to the door, look behind the door, where's the, you know, fire exit, you know, right, left. I mean, like, literally walking through it with her. And then I said, okay, go. And she ran, and she went out, and she got out of the hotel, thank God. And a few years later, it was interesting. I'd never met her. I didn't know her. We were at a company retreat, and this lady tapped me on the shoulder, and I turned around, and she said, you know, I'm so-and-so. And she had tears in her eyes, and she said, you saved my life. And that was a very, very special.
So for a story like that, do you even leave? What do? Are you there 20 hours, 30 hours?
Yeah, you're there. You're there for however long you need to be. Yeah.
You know, I've been at the CNN headquarters, and you get into some of those control rooms. It's astonishing, you know, how much is happening because it's live. And how do you balance the need to be first or the balance to be right?
Yeah, well, you better be right. Yeah, and it's gotten tougher, you know. The patience and the expectations of the viewers and the readers, you know, with social media especially, everything is so much more immediate. We thought we were immediate because we were 24/7 constantly and deadline all the time. It wasn't like we were preparing for a 6 o'clock newscast. But truly, with technology change and how our own way of news consumption has changed, that when something gets tweeted out, you know, the expectation, okay, CNN, do you have this or not? And it's very important, and it's very tough, and you have your people who are, you know, the editors on the desks, the reporters, producers in the field trying to get the story, and then you have your control room calling and say, do we have it yet? Do we have it yet? And there's certainly a lot of tension there, but you want to wait and get it right before you're first. That's not the record to have if it's going to be wrong.
You talked a little bit about some of your memorable days. Is there a worst day? And what did you actually learn from that? Because sometimes, as we all know, we learn from things that don't go well.
Yeah. Well, there were a lot of tough days. 9/11 was a horrible day. 9/11 was a horrible day. We were all in 8 o'clock board editorial meeting, and I remember I was just international would always go first, so I was about to kind of tell the folks what we were doing that day. And Edith Chapin, a dear colleague who was in New York and now runs NPR News, she came on the phone and she said, "We're hearing a plane has just gone into one of the towers," and everybody's just like in unison, everybody just got up and rushed out and went downstairs to the main newsroom. And as we were going, and they had just put out the picture, and you could see the tower was on fire. We don't know what we were thinking, but we just thought maybe a small plane or something had gone in. And then soon after that, we saw the second one go in. And then, we heard there's a fire at the Pentagon, and like, of all things, there's a fire in the Pentagon today. And then, nobody knew at the time that there was another plane that had gone into the Pentagon, and then the plane crashing, and it just seemed like Armageddon. It just seemed like it was happening, and another thing was happening. It was like, where is it stopping? And the reaction of the newsroom was just, the intensity was palpable. And remember, at the time, we had, Nick was in Afghanistan for a story. There were a couple of missionaries who were on trial, if I remember correctly. And a few hours into it, I just called him. I said, "Nick, I don't know what's happening. We have no idea what's happening, but we're just putting everybody on alert around the world, and just kind of in case this." Well, it seemed like it was obviously coordinated, not knowing what the source was. So.
Yeah, that was a dramatic day for all of us. And when you're in a newsroom, you galvanize around the story, and you almost have to put what you're thinking aside. One, we talked a bit about the changes in technology, but one of the things you didn't mention, but it's really, I think, potentially revolutionary, are drones.
Yeah.
If you were running a news organization now, how would you imagine using drones?
And drones are being used. It certainly has positives and negatives. I certainly appreciate that, not just as a journalist, but as a citizen. The privacy factor is important. But then there are stories that drones can be a great safety factor for journalists. When you have fires or you have other things that you don't want to send people close to, but you want to get the full picture and get the story. There are a lot of pluses, when you have tragedies or when you have, I guess, more and more, maybe in some of these war zones, that might be the longer distances, and I can see how that can become something that you can cover the story much more comprehensively. And with the VR technology, virtual reality that I was talking about, those things can, with 360 cameras, it really will make you experience the stories more, which can be a good thing.
One of the, we mentioned earlier the incredible logistics of getting your equipment into some Mogadishu, but, one of the realities with television news is when you're there, people know you're there. When you're a print reporter, you can stick your notebook in your pocket and be invisible. And did you experience, or do you ever think, sometimes, I've seen situations where, especially in like riot situations, the cameras would show up, the lights would go on, and stuff would happen. Did you ever have a sense or have concerns about the fact that cameras could influence an event or precipitate one, or do you have any examples where that happened, or is it something you even thought about when you came in with a crew?
Absolutely, you talked about it. You thought about it, and it certainly did. Sometimes, if it really impacted the situation, you would speak to that in your report because you didn't want to seem like well, this is happening naturally. You would just say, "Well, the crowd has now gathered around us. That the cameras are out and so forth." And yeah, there were many instances that when the camera would go up, the tripod would go up, and you're present. It the curiosity would be there, and you know, in some cases it would be dangerous as well. Nowadays, again, the positive thing is that the gears are smaller. You know, back then you had a huge camera, and then you had your sound tech guy behind you with a wire hanging behind him and the big tripod, and you know, much more obvious and visible. And now, you know, it can be a smaller cell phone, so we can be more discreet in more dangerous places, which is a good thing.
So you've had a remarkable career, and we have time for one last question. On a personal level, what advice would you give a young lady like yourself if you were talking to her now, 30 years later or more? And also another asset, I think, is who you are as a person. So, and can you speak a little bit to the necessity and strength of diversity in newsrooms?
Yeah. Well, that is a very special point and very dear to my heart, diversity in newsrooms. Helped build a little UN at CNN. I think it is so important, you know, the languages, the nationalities, the backgrounds, the cultural diversity. It was always so important. It made us a much stronger newsroom, a much stronger news organization in the field, not to mention even having the diversity of passports and being able to travel around the world with, you know, much easier. And also, you know, I think as a leader for anybody, it's important to have a diverse workforce because it also brings about a diversity in personality. You know, if I had a tough interview, if I wanted to get an interview with somebody who didn't want to talk to us or was very elusive, I wouldn't assign it to my type A loud, you know, editor. I would assign it to my quiet, patient, determined, detail-oriented editor who would call every hour on the hour for days if they had to, and they would get that interview. And I think that's so important, any kind of a team, to have that kind of a diversity of just backgrounds, languages, and abilities.
What advice would you have for a young journalist today, or someone who wants to get into journalism?
I would say do it for the right reason. You know, we've become such a celebrity oriented mindset sometimes that, you know, sometimes people get into it for that, and that's not the right reason to get into it. You want to kind of get into journalism because you want to tell the stories and give voice to the voiceless and shed light on areas that need to be visible. So doing it for the right reason is going to be the key because it's very demanding, it's round the clock, you have to love it. And you have to have the passion for it because it's going to be very demanding. But do it. If you love it, go for it. Mr. Wagner.
It's time to thank Parisa Khosravi for her presentation today. We also thank our audiences here, those listening to the recording, and on the internet. I'm Robert Rosenthal, moderator for today's program, Challenges to International News Reporting. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 110 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.